Hello and welcome back to the Existential Echo Chamber podcast. For those of you who have been following along, I'm going to continue to read posts from my blog. For those of you who are new, you will notice that the first 9 episodes have been mostly blog readings. But don't worry, this podcast is not just historical, religious, philosophical discussions or blog readings. Once I am done getting these blog posts turned into podcast, I'm going to transition into pop culture, politics, sports, all sorts of fun stuff. I'm going to have interviews with people. We're going to have a lot of fun. So thank you for listening, and I hope you will continue to stick around. So today's post that I'm going to be reading from the blog was published on Good Friday, April the 10th of this year, 2020. And it was entitled, Good Friday, Forging Meaning from Malevolence. Jesus answered them, "Do you now believe? The hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each one to his home, and you will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. I have said this to you so that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart. I have overcome the world." John 16:31-33. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. Mark 15:33-34 and 37. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon, while the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his last. Luke 23:44-46. This isn't going to be a super long post. I'm not going to go into much historical detail about discrepancies in the gospel narrative about the crucifixion. I will spare you a long discussion of how the crucifixion provided the disciples with an ultra-mega case of cognitive dissonance. For now, anyway, that will be the subject of the next post. I'm not going to spend any time trying to demonstrate that the death of Jesus was nothing more than the logical result of a horrible miscalculation on the part of a religious fanatic, which it absolutely, historically speaking, was. Instead, rather, I'm going to tell you what Good Friday means to me, and what I hope it can mean for you, regardless of your theological beliefs or lack thereof. The story of Jesus, as presented in the New Testament, is not true in the sense that it represents historically sound narratives or some sort of empirically valid fact about humanity. But empiricism is simply one layer of analysis, one important way in which something can be considered true. It is not, however, the only way. This may frustrate some of my atheist readers who value empiricism above all else, but there are, I propose, other ways in which something that does not represent scientific fact can be true. Stories exist to help us make sense of being human, to explain why bad things happen, and to explain why we shouldn't give up. Religious stories are no exception. They contain the hard-earned collective wisdom of our past, and they share our redemptive hopes for the future. They offer us advice, examples, and hope. The reason we gravitate towards them is because they reflect who we are as a species, the good, the bad, and the ugly. No wonder we read ourselves into these stories. It's one of the chief reasons they were told in the first place. A story need not be historically accurate to hold relevance for our lives. In what way is the biblical story of Jesus significantly different from the modern mythologies that shape our society? Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Superman, etc. Do we cast aside Tolkien's work as worthless because no such place as the Shire exists? Do we say that the great themes of love, friendship, and sacrifice in Harry Potter are null and void because Hogwarts isn't a real school and magic defies the known laws of physics? Of course not. Now, you might argue that modern literary examples haven't sparked religious devotion, and that religious devotion sometimes leads to suffering. Your point is valid, but it doesn't invalidate mine. The fact remains that these stories exist to tell us something about the human condition, and it is entirely arrogant to assume that we can throw the baby out with the bathwater simply because those stories don't align with a post-Enlightenment understanding of what is true. These stories serve humanities in ways that empiricism, by its very nature, cannot. Now let me be clear. I don't believe in the traditional understanding of God. I do not believe Jesus of Nazareth ever claimed to be God, and I do not believe that Jesus died for some grand cosmic plan to save people's souls from eternal separation from God. Nor do I believe the Bible even teaches such a doctrine. But that is not the sense in which I believe the story of Jesus represents ideas that are true. It is my contention, rather, that even if something is historically inaccurate, it can, nonetheless, be practically true. In other words, if a set of ideals, beliefs, or values derived from Scripture can have a positive, real-world application that helps inspire an individual to get along better with others and have a happier, more productive life, then from a pragmatic standpoint, those beliefs are true. For example, it is true that the world would be a better place if we treated each other with respect, helped one another to maintain basic human dignity, and raised our children to prefer love over violence. And that truth exists on a practical level, regardless of whether or not Jesus or any other religious leader from any other tradition uttered the phrase, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." It is true that we should have compassion on the poor, the sick, and the weakest members of our society. That is true irrespective of whether or not Jesus healed sick people or delivered the Sermon on the Mount. Now, you may argue that you knew all of those things already, and you don't need a religious leader to tell you how to be a good person. You're probably right. Most people living in our modern society in a free country founded on post-Enlightenment and Judeo-Christian values come to this understanding from merely growing up in a society that champions these ideals, whether or not you would ever darken the door of a church, synagogue, or a mosque. You can live a genuinely moral, good life without being a Christian. I do it every single day, and so do most of my non-religious friends. My point is not that you need some supernatural guidance from God to be a good person. My point, rather, is that these ideas don't come from God. They come from people. Religious stories represent the collective, hard-earned life experiences our ancestors had that have been worked into a narrative and passed on to us generation after generation precisely because they contain these sorts of non-empirical truths I have been discussing. And because the story of Jesus, a committed Jew, was written and passed along primarily by men and women who were steeped in the Greco-Roman culture, they represent a blending of the values of Jerusalem and Athens. These are the very same values that would later come to inform much of Western civilization. So it is no surprise that these stories contain thoughts and ideas that conform to the practical truths which help shape our culture and build our society. Like all human endeavors, these stories are flawed. Their flaws can be seen across multiple layers of analysis just as readily, if not more so, than the truths they contain. But flaws do not negate truths, and I still believe that there is a valuable, symbolic story contained in the Passion narrative that relates to each and every one of us on a fundamental level which speaks to the very heart of what it means to be alive and conscious as a human being. It's a story that is as vital and necessary for some today as it's ever been. I will conclude this post by attempting to summarize what the story of Jesus means for me and why his death inspires me. You're free to reach your own conclusions. For the believer, my story may not extend far enough. For the staunch atheist, it may be an eye roller. But neither response in any way invalidates the pragmatic truth of what I am about to suggest. In all of my time studying the Bible, I have stumbled upon a set of key ideas that seem to be of great significance in some ways for Scripture, but also represent practical truths. Number one, The world is full of malevolence. Life, especially for people living prior to the medical and technological advancements of the last century, has been filled with sadness, chaos, and pain for most people who have ever lived and died on planet Earth. In response to the fact that life is full of chaos, malevolence, and hardships, it is our job as human beings to confront the world head-on and try as best we can, for as long as we can, to create as much order from chaos of the world as we possibly can, to lessen the suffering of others and to protect our friends and families. We cannot hope to do this without first making a decision for ourselves about how we personally will respond to malevolence in the world. Number two, the decision of each of us is one that we must make whether or not we will take up the sacred charge to rage against the chaos of our lives and help lessen the suffering of others, or to run from this horrifying task and accept defeat. This is a daily challenge. The sword must be drawn every morning or the darkness will swallow us. Number three, sometimes if we choose to fight, we will die, metaphorically speaking. This is okay. It is okay to fail. It is not okay to stay down and refuse to get back up. We learn who we are from failure. Acting as a kind of symbolic death by sacrificing the weaker elements of our being, failure makes us stronger. Number four, getting back up after we fall represents a resurrection of sorts, a rebirth, a chance to try again. In the war on chaos and suffering, there is no end and there can be no surrender. Number five, overcoming the world by getting back up one more time than we fall down is how we are transformed into the kind of person who can genuinely help lessen the suffering of others. Because we cannot truly take on the suffering of others until we learn to embrace our own suffering. Once we have learned this essential truth, we can begin to create a genuinely better world with less suffering, more compassion, and a greater sense of community. The classic themes represented in religious texts, especially the Bible, reflect our own struggles to face and overcome the challenges of life. This is why people the world over can relate so strongly to the notions of forgiveness, redemption, and hope found in its pages. Like Moses, we too have periods wandering the desert trying to sort out who and what we are. In the same way that Daniel found himself surrounded by hungry lions, we also feel beset on all sides by problems that seek to devour us. And like the disciples, we frequently fail to understand the messages that life tries to teach us and deny the answers we already know to be right. Like Jesus, we also must face our own Calvary. Each one of us, and the simple act of waking up every morning and accepting the call to combat chaos, is constantly engaged in a process of bearing our own cross, onwards and upwards, towards our own death. As we grow, learn, and live the experience of being, this experience changes us. Sometimes this change is incredibly painful. Sometimes we are dragged, kicking and screaming up the hill towards our own crucifixion, asking why God has forsaken us, or why fate has dealt us this hand. Other times, we willingly choose to crucify parts of ourselves that are destructive and holding us back. We make a bargain with the future. If I sacrifice this part of me now, something better, even transcendent, may emerge later. This is the pattern we model for our children as we teach them to get back up when they crash a bicycle. It's the logic behind formative assessments in a classroom when we engage students with difficult problems and help them find ways to overcome these academic challenges. It's the lesson we impart to ourselves every single time we steel up our courage to give romance another try as we prepare for another first date. Life is hard. It's painful. It can be overwhelming. But we must not shy away from giving it our best shot, and sometimes our best shot is not going to be good enough. In those moments of failure, we are forced to reassess, readjust, and crucify those parts of our lives that are keeping us from reaching our potential. This often takes incredible courage, and it can be unbelievably difficult, but if we ever wish to rise from the ashes of our own defeat, we have to pick up that cross and start walking. The only other choice is giving up, and that is the most terrible thing we can do. As Rocky Balboa so brilliantly opined, the world is a mean, cruel, nasty place, and it will beat you to the ground and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody will ever hit as hard as life. But it's not about how hard you can hit. It's about how hard you can get hit, how much you can take, and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. And so we get up. We keep moving. We clean up as much of the mess as we can for as long as we can. And we strive to do better, to be better. We've all spent time in the Garden of Gethsemane, wishing the cup of our own suffering could pass us by without having to drink from it. We've all wrestled our own demons, gotten a personal glimpse into our own tailor-made hell, and been misunderstood, rejected, and mocked by those who we thought were our friends. Jesus maintained that powerful demonic forces were harassing people, infecting their lives, and bringing ruin on the earth. Today, we might think of anxiety, depression, addiction, suicidal thoughts, racism, sexism, and violence as modern ways of expressing these same fundamental problems facing humanity. In light of the suffering of others, Jesus promised redemption in the very near future, but he also offered comfort, companionship, and love in the present. He knew full well that he could not alleviate the suffering of every person he came in contact with, but he also knew that that was no excuse to stop trying. Jesus was true to himself. His convictions may have been wrong, but they also led him and countless others who would follow his example for generations to come to strive for compassion, to treat others with decency, and to help the poor, sick, and dying whom society so often cast aside as undesirables. His refusal to stop fighting for what he believed to be correct is ultimately what got him killed, and it's also what makes him one of the greatest archetypal heroes of all time. The message that I take away from Good Friday is simply this. It's okay that Jesus didn't live to see his dream of a better world with no more suffering become a reality. Everybody dies sometime. And this war against suffering was never going to be won by a single Messiah, no matter how badly we wish it worked that way. Jesus lost. He died. But the ideas his story embody, love rather than hatred, compassion rather than judgment, hope rather than despair, courage rather than fear, love of life over fear of death. These are all true ideas. They work. They matter. They provide meaning, purpose, and a goal to work towards. Suffering is our enemy. These ideas can serve as weapons to help fight the war. Remember, fairy tales do not exist to tell us about dragons. They exist to tell us that dragons can be defeated. It may be true that his message has been co-opted to cause rather than alleviate suffering. For generations, Christians persecuted Jews. History is replete with crusades, witch trials, slavery, bigotry, and ignorance. Many followers of Jesus have forgotten his teachings or warped them to justify inflicting pain or seizing power. But there will always be those who choose chaos over order. It's easier that way. Chaos belongs to the cowards. Like Jesus, we must fight against these forces of darkness too. Dogmatism is one of the great ills of our society, and free-thinking people must speak out whenever and wherever any tyranny over the mind of man is present. Whether it is espoused in the homophobic pulpit of a fundamentalist church, embedded in the language of a bill designed to legislate morality by curbing individual liberty, or utilized to justify a suicide bombing by a radical Muslim seeking the approval of a vengeful God. We cannot ignore these threats to civility, but we must engage the front lines of this conflict with love, compassion, and the conviction that the battle is worth fighting despite knowing we may lose, so long as the war is not lost. In the final analysis, Good Friday shows us that sometimes bad things happen to well-intentioned people. It challenges us to have the courage, despite this knowledge, to keep trying to make the world a better place regardless. The early followers of Jesus experienced their greatest defeat on this day 2 millennia ago. But defeat would not be the end of their story, and it doesn't have to be the end of ours. The night is always darkest, just before the dawn. But the dawn is coming. So to those of you who are feeling defeated right now, you have to get up. You can't stay down. You have to keep moving. Just a little longer. After all, Sunday's on the way. In the words of one of my favorite songs of all time, we may not reach the ending, but we can start, slowly but truly mending, brick by brick, heart by heart. Now, maybe now, we start learning how. We can build a beautiful city. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. We can build a beautiful city, not a city of angels, but we can build a city of man.